welcome to the More Deadly Podcast, where we review horror movies directed by a woman that prove that the female of the species is more deadly than the male. I'm your co-host, Rachel, and joining me is one of my favorite people in the whole world, Ariel.
Hello.
Hey, girl. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah, you hanging in there?
Yeah, a little restless, but, you know, survive.
I know. I wish I could say that I was, like, using this time really productively, but I'm totally not. No. Like, I was like, I'm going to catch up on all the things I haven't seen. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to purge the closet. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. No, I've been watching trash reality TV, learning to make soup, like, just chilling like a villain.
Yeah, no, I haven't done anything real worthwhile either.
I'm an advocate for, like, saying fuck it and just being lazy while we're in quarantine.
Yeah, like, I kept opening up Duolingo, and I'm like, I'm gonna work on that again. Maybe I'll finally become fluent in Spanish.
Same thing.
Not gonna happen.
I know. I'd like to come out of this, like, you know, more well-versed person.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think probably...
We'll be more well-versed on reality shows.
That's true. And women in horror.
Yes. Because
I'll tell you what, quarantine is good for podcasting.
Very true.
You have time to record, you have time to edit.
Yeah, and we don't even have to be near each other.
Right? This is my kind of sport, right? Oh, awesome. All right, well, speaking of podcasting, we are going to be reviewing a little movie called Blood and Donuts. Oh, before we go ahead, I have a little bit of housekeeping, something I forgot to talk about on the last episode.
Yeah.
Which is that you may have noticed that we have a new theme song.
Yay.
Yeah. So this one is actually created for us by one DJ Sharton, who is my co-host on the cast of Ka and a longtime friend of mine from the back in the Splattercast days, who when we told him about the podcast and I kind of describing what the vibe of it was, got very excited. He's a musician and a filmmaker and just like a general creative kind of dude. And he offered to make us a theme song. And I was like, yes, please. So thank you so much to DJ for our awesome music.
Yeah, thank you, DJ. It's amazing.
Not that he'll ever listen, but this is more like... I feel better about it, giving him the credit that he's due, even if he'll never, ever know. All right. So, housekeeping. Do we have any corrections from the last episode we need to talk about?
Not that I can think of. I mean, in all likelihood, I probably got something wrong, but I don't know what it is. So.
Well, I mean, technically, I was the one that gave all the background. So, if anybody messed up last night, it was me. But unlike you, I'm a terrible journalist and didn't bother to come back and figure out if I made any mistakes. Once it's said on the show, it is canon.
Yes, exactly.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So... we're going to be, did I already say what we're reviewing today? Okay, cool. So before we get into our review of Blood and Donuts, can you please let our listeners who may have stumbled on the show for the first time today, what our spoiler policy is?
We are going to spoil everything. For example, if we were reviewing The Sixth Sense, we would immediately tell you that Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. So.
Spoiler alert. I almost spit out my Diet Coke. Anything else you want to destroy? Okay, so point is, fair warning, beyond this point, nothing is sacred, especially no plot points or details of Blood and Donuts. All right, so now this one was a movie that you selected. Can you tell me a little bit about why you opted for Blood and Donuts?
Yeah, you know, I kept seeing this on lists of, like, you know, movies that you may not have heard of that you should watch. And it had been on, like, our horror, like, women directed horror movie list. And it just sounded really interesting to me. So I wanted to check it out.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good, perfectly legit reason. Okay. So tell me a little bit about this movie and about its director, Holly Dale.
Okay. So this is quickly becoming, like, my favorite part about the podcast almost, is, like, doing the research beforehand on these different directors, because you find out so many interesting things about them.
That's so cool. I know what you mean. Like, so far I've gone into this being like, I love women in horror. That's so cool. And then you find out details about them. And yeah, I agree with you 100%. Like, they're 10 times cooler than I even imagined.
Yeah, exactly. So Holly Dale has a really interesting story. She had a pretty rough home life, and so she left home at 15 and ended up living on the streets of Toronto for quite a while. And but she was actually able to enroll in film school at Sheridan College. And while she was there, she got to know this woman, Janice Cole, who was a fellow student there, who also had spent time on the streets, and they started collaborating. So their whole idea of collaboration together was to make films that attempted to like break down stereotypes and focus on people on the fringes of society, kind of like the people they had gotten to know when they were younger.
Interesting. That tells you, that informs a lot about this movie.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So the first film that they ever made was a 10-minute documentary about a body rub parlor. So apparently what happened was she had been told by a teacher, like, make something about what you know, because she didn't know what to make her first movie about. And she had had a friend who owned a body rub parlor who owed her $300. So she convinced this guy to let her make a movie there. So
now,
she...
by body rub parlor, do you mean happy
That's what
ending?
They called it, but it was like non-therapeutic massage parlor.
Okay. So groin massage. Got it.
Yes. Yes. Eloquently put.
Well, you know, I'm nothing. I'm not a classy lady.
So what they ended up doing was actually pretty cool. They bugged all of the rooms with the consent of the women who worked there, but without the knowledge of any of the customers.
Ooh.
And then just like filmed and recorded everything that happened. And then they turned that into a documentary.
Is it possible to get your hands on said documentary?
Was not able to get my hands on it.
Darn. Exactly. I would totally want to watch that.
Yeah. Yeah. So after that, they both continued to work together and collaborate and went on to make like a bunch of documentaries. So award-winning documentaries too.
Awesome.
They did one about sex workers where they again used this technique where they talked to different sex workers and like got their agreement to be filmed and to wear mics. And then went and filmed them while they were going about their day and like doing their job and turned it into this documentary. Mm-hmm. And then they made another one about a women's prison with interviews with all of these different women in prison. And I guess it was pretty groundbreaking because nobody had done that in Canada before.
Wow.
They also made a cool documentary called Calling the Shots about women filmmakers in the 80s.
Oh,
so they did
cool.
A lot of good stuff. Yeah. So Blood and Donuts was her first non-documentary film that she ever made. And I'll get into Blood and Donuts more in a minute. But after that, in the late 90s, she moved into directing TV shows. And she has directed so many TV shows, like really highly rated TV shows.
I did peek at her IMDb and I was like, because it always makes me sad when you like see these, especially with these like older movies and you look at their recent stuff and they haven't done anything since 1997. You're like, bummer. But I was like, excuse you. Good for you.
Yeah. So even though she stopped making documentaries, she really credits her work on documentaries with teaching her how to deal with sensitive subject matter, but also she said sensitive people. Like learning how to work with people in these documentary settings where you were having them talk about their real lives and maybe really, you know, kind of awful situations allows her to be really sensitive to the needs of actors and learn how to like get the best out of them and talk to them. She also said that working on these sort of smaller budget projects doing documentaries taught her how to do almost like every aspect of filmmaking, which really helped her when she got into TV, because she could really speak with authority about everything.
Good.
Yeah. So she's directed episodes of a million TV shows, including Dexter, the new season of The X-Files, Grimm, a couple different Law and Orders, The Americans, Cold Case, Sarah Connor's Chronicles, like just a bunch of different TV shows.
That's awesome.
Yeah. She's been recognized as the best director by the Directors Guild of Canada three separate times. For the shows Flashpoint, Being Erica, and Mary Kills People. And apparently Mary Kills People, she made like the entire first season. So she really got to direct like what the look and feel of that show was going to be going forward.
I need to check that out. It keeps like popping up and I don't quite, I haven't quite gone there yet, but I keep going like, oh, I need to check that out. But now I feel even more inspired.
Yeah,
now
that I know that
how influential Holly Dale was with this.
Yeah, exactly. And right now she's actually working as the producing director on Batwoman.
Oh.
Yeah. And she says that she is really excited about her work on this show because she's a queer woman and it's the first lesbian superhero to ever mm-hmm. be on TV. And she said that she's really happy about it because her sexual orientation isn't just something that's kind of offhandedly mentioned, that it's actually like part of the plot of the show.
God, I'm so ashamed of myself. I have not watched any Batwoman. Have you?
No, I've seen some of the crossover stuff.
Uh-huh.
Because I watched like The Flash with my nephew.
Gotcha.
But I haven't actually watched it.
Yeah. Yeah, I got so burnt out by The Flash and Green Arrow that I couldn't bring myself to dig back in. The only one I still watch is Legends of Tomorrow because it's like so wacky and joyful. Right. Which, by the way, excellent TV Prozac if you're not watching that.
Are you watching that? I have been because you told me to.
Okay.
Season one is woof, but
season two and on is magical. but yeah, so like I feel a little ashamed. I need to get into Batwoman because it's all the things I like. I got so burned by Green Arrow and The Flash that I was like, I'm done with CW superheroes, but I need to watch Batwoman. Come on.
Yeah, I didn't realize that they made her. I mean, I knew she was played by
Ruby Rose.
Ruby Rose, but I didn't know that she was going to have like a gay arc on the show, whatever. Or
I mean, I know the source material, you know, it's based on the comic series where she is a lesbian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. So.
Yeah, and she talked in an interview, Holly Dale talked in an interview about the fact that she never got to see herself on TV when she was mm-hmm. growing up, and that making something like this is really important to her because she wants people to be able, you know, who like all of these young queer women coming up being able to see this on television.
Ugh, that's awesome. Be the change you want to see in the world, literally.
Exactly. So I read a number of interviews with her, and it sounds like getting into directing was a pretty tough and tall order at the time, like in the late 70s, early 80s.
I mean, think of how hard it is now.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, she said that there were just almost no women directors in Canada at the time, hardly any in the United States, that it was really, really tough to get into the industry, and that documentaries were kind of something that women could do at the time, mm-hmm. I guess. And that she was able to basically sort of use what she had learned through making the documentaries to get her into filmmaking, but that mm-hmm. it had a large part of that had to do with the making of Blood and Donuts, which I'll get into in a second. But one of the interesting things that she said was that once she actually started directing drama for movies and television, it was hard to get men to listen to her. Directors and other people, that it was just difficult to have somebody like take her seriously. Mm-hmm. She said that one of the things that really helped is she was willing to travel anywhere, so she could just take any job at any location, and that mm-hmm. really helped get her foot in the door. But that she said these days she thinks things have changed a lot, and she said that in an She said in an interview that she thinks the difference today is that there are a lot of men in the industry who were raised by feminist mothers and don't have the same issue taking direction from women.
Oh.
That's pretty great.
That is great. I mean, that's awesome. Dismantle the patriarchy.
Right.
Moms are on the front line of that, you know?
Yeah.
So that's interesting, though, that it's like showing up that she's been in the industry long enough that like she is recognizing it. I feel like it's easy to also get caught up in the ways that inequality still exists.
Yeah.
So it's kind of exciting to hear how it actually, like all of the griping and all of the pushing and all of the awareness raising that is being done actually has an impact, because sometimes it feels like just like evil always wins.
Right.
Bad guys always win. So it's, I kind of, clinging to this little piece of information,
I know.
Maybe a little too hard, but like,
no,
that's really awesome to hear.
Yeah. And she also said that, you know, it's not perfect. There still need to be more women hired behind the scenes, but she said her piece of advice was like, once you get into the industry, hire as many women as you possibly can.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so I said before that Blood and Donuts was her first non-documentary film. It was also the first film she ever made without her film partner, Janice Cole, who was the one she made the documentaries about. And it was the first film ever produced by the Feature Film Project, which apparently is an initiative of the Canadian Film Center, which is like AFI in the U.S. So the Canadian Film Center had just started, and Dale was part of the first group of 12 residents accepted into the program. Now it's like a much larger program. I think they have 100 residents at a time, but it was pretty small when she started. And they wanted to produce a movie, and they wanted to pick somebody who had been a former resident of the program, and she was picked to direct based on one of the short films she had made.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So, and that really, she was able to like parlay into this like big career. Like she got her foot in the door doing something other than documentaries, and that really helped. And she said that she really liked the script for Blood and Donuts when she read it because it wasn't set in any particular time or place. And she said that she loves fantasy stories because she feels like it's a great vehicle to get people to understand your message, which I feel like is something we say over and over again when we're talking about horror.
Yeah, it is the spoonful of sugar.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you can couch it in metaphor, you can avoid someone's defenses coming up really quickly. Mm-hmm. They can like ponder something and come to a conclusion on their own. And I think all the genres kind of do that. So yeah, I totally agree with that sentiment.
Yeah. And then it was nominated for 3 Genie Awards, which I hadn't heard of before, but from when I was looking it up online, it sounds like the Canadian version of the Academy Awards. I guess the awards are called something different now. It's not called the Genie Award, but it was when she was nominated. So that's pretty cool.
That's very cool. This is so interesting. Like, she is someone who has a very storied career, and yet the only thing I've ever heard of her was this movie, and it was only ever because it's sort of like a trivia of, like, it's always on a list of movies directed by women. I would never have guessed, based on the way that this is sort of just a footnote, how accomplished she is.
Yeah, I mean, because the TV shows I listed off are like a tiny percentage of the things that she's done. And she's working constantly. It's pretty amazing. Since like the mid-90s when she started doing TV, she's like basically never not directing television shows.
Good for her.
Yeah, yes. And then she said that although she's a feminist, this wasn't like a feminist-specific project, but that she said, quote, in an interview, there's a definite feminist brushstroke throughout the whole piece, but it's not written as a feminist project. So
yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see both sides of that argument.
Yes, exactly.
Awesome. Okay, you're right. This is the best part of the podcast. You did such a good job. Again, I'm shamed. Oh, I'm shamed by your ability to do the research and put this together. It's so interesting. Now I'm going to say a lot of less interesting things about the movie. Oh, awesome. Okay, well, it's my job to do the synopsis. Yes. So here is what Blood and Donuts is about. Again, spoiler warnings. All right, so a nice Canadian vampire named Boya crawled into a bag in 1969, the same night that we landed on the moon. He stayed there for 25 years until a golfer accidentally hit a golf ball through the window of the warehouse that he was slumbering in. When he wakes up, he's disoriented. He has really long fingernails. and he emerges from his warehouse only to discover that the world has changed quite a bit. He makes his way to a donut shop that used to be a butcher shop or a restaurant. It's a bar. And he's looking to get his hands on some liver. Liver is not available, so instead he eats a bunch of animals because he is a nice vampire who is trying not to eat humans anymore. While he's there, he ends up kind of getting enmeshed in the drama around this cab driver named Earl, who has caught the attention of some local toughs. And he also kind of falls in love with the woman who runs the donut shop, who is very beautiful in the most 1990s way.
Very true.
Like, peak 1990s, everything about her. Complicating matters, in addition to this group of bad guys led by Dina Cronenberg, there is an ex that he had left when he disappeared into his bag in 1969, who is hot on his tail. As soon as he awakens, she senses that he has awakened, and she is still hoping to be able to be turned into a vampire and hold on to the last bits of her beauty. And by befriending Earl, Boya gets pulled into all this drama with the bad guys, and it's up to him to save Earl and also just kind of deal with, like, pretty intense vampire-related depression, all the while falling in love with Molly reluctantly and ends up sacrificing himself so that he doesn't draw them into his dark vampiric web. The end. How was that? Was that okay?
Great. Yeah, that was great.
Okay, good.
I like the spooky ending.
I know. A twist. He wasn't in the trunk. He wasn't in the trunk.
Oh, God.
All right. So let's talk about what we liked about this movie. You want to tell me things that you enjoyed about it?
Yeah, I actually really liked this movie. It's a
good.
It's silly. Like, it's a silly movie.
Yeah, but I actually true.
Yeah, but I thought it was really entertaining. The very beginning of the movie feels like you're about to enter, like, a rom-com.
Oh, interesting.
The way it's playing, like, Mr. Sandman and, like, the golf balls being swung at the title cards. Like, it felt very romantic comedy-ish to me.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I just think this movie is really fun. Like, Earl the cabbie has the most ridiculous accent I've ever heard, but I loved
him. You mean
him.
Clarence Rat Christopher Walken?
What was that accent?
He was Christopher Walkening. Like, that's the only thing time. I can. At first, I was like, is he Russian? Like, what is happening here? And then I heard enough of him, and I was watching with my partner, who was like, no, he's being Christopher Walken. And then that's, like, all I could hear. It was fully distracting.
Yeah. But even with the ridiculous Walken accent, I loved his character. I thought Earl was great and really adds, like, to the humor of the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the whole, like, donut shop thing was fun and interesting. The mob boss stuff is, like, it's goofy, but it was really fun. Watching David Cronenberg be a crime boss was pretty great. And those glasses were amazing.
Yeah. His hair, his like pompadour is so good.
Yeah. And I just thought he was great. Like, his whole vibe was awesome.
Yeah.
She even said, Holly Dale, in an interview, that working with him was really great, and she thought that he had, like, a ton of fun on the set because he didn't have to, like, be controlling everything because he wasn't a director. He just got to have fun with it.
Yeah, he looks like he's having an absolute blast.
Yeah.
Nobody is having more fun on the set of Blood and Donuts than David Cronenberg.
Exactly.
Like, he's having his full Tarantino moment.
Yeah. I even thought that, like, the vampire special effects, like, when his face does the, like, Buffy vampire transformation.
Which, 2 years before Buffy the Vampire series came out.
Exactly.
Just saying.
Yep.
Just saying.
It looks just like that. But I even thought that was pretty good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and some of the way that it was filmed too, like, there's a scene where he's sitting in the donut shop, and he starts, like, hearing all the different noises that are happening in different parts of the restaurant, and mm-hmm. the camera, like, pans to all of these different places while he's, like, where you just hear his breathing in the background. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really cool. Also, there's a scene where he is chasing after a rat so he can drink its blood.
I know. Oh, when he's, like, running on the floor.
Yeah, and the camera's, like, right down on the floor.
Yeah, you're right.
I thought that was really well done.
Like, mm-hmm.
Really cool.
Yeah.
There's some good practical effects, like when his old, like, love from the past stabs him through the chest and he has to rip out that giant steak.
Yes. She's unwell. She does not. I mean, like, I don't think anybody takes rejection well, but the, like, murderous move, it's not a good look.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I also thought there were a lot of, like, really silly, funny moments. For instance, Earl the cabbie is in his cab, like, killing time, and he does that taxi driver, you looking at me thing in his mirror, but instead he says, are you inferring to me? And it's Christopher Walken accent. He's like Christopher Walken trying to be De Niro. That made me laugh. I thought that was really funny.
He's definitely making a character choice in this movie.
Yes. There's a big swing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll leave it up to you whether you think it was a hit or a miss.
And then there's another moment with Earl where, Boya the vampire is letting him stay at his, like, little, I don't know, sleazy motel room.
Yeah.
And
which has Earl... the most beautiful dresser in it. I know it doesn't matter, it's not the point. But no, like I kept being like, I need to travel back in time
to grab that
to
dresser.
Where like when Art Deco furniture was mm-hmm. the like yeah. put stuff you put in a sleazy hotel so I can afford it. Sorry, I know there's important things, but I was fully distracted by the dresser.
Yeah, agreed. So he comes in the room and it's daylight and all the curtains are drawn. He just like immediately opens them up.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the vampire boy is like, oh, I'm gonna get burned. And he says, oh yeah, sorry, I 100% forgot. Like, anyways, it was just stuff like that I thought actually were pretty funny. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where he walks in on him in the bathroom while boy
is in the bath. He's got the feathers all around his mouth.
Yeah, there's just like dead pigeons all over the floor and feathers stuck to his mouth.
Yeah, like you could not be more busted.
Yeah, yeah.
If there's still feathers stuck in your mouth, it's like a Looney Tunes where there's like feathers stuck to Sylvester's mouth.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of funny because I think it's shortly after we have that scene where Earl is sitting there watching Looney Tunes. So I think it's kind of a callback to that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's got to be. You're right. Yeah. Definitely.
Awesome.
Yeah, and one of the big plot lines, like one of the through lines of the movie is that Boya's attempting to like not eat any humans, like not drink any human blood. But at the very beginning, before you kind of like know what the deal is, he walks by this homeless man. And you think for a second he's going to do it, and then he doesn't, which, you know, I really appreciate it. A lot of times, like, people living on the street are just kind of like cannon fodder in movies, mm-hmm. you know? So mm-hmm. it was nice to see that not happen. Again, when he's in his sleazy motel, there's, like, an elderly man in a walker going down, and he also doesn't intentionally eat that guy. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Right. Those are the little show-don't-tell moments where you learn a lot about
exactly.
Boya's character. Which, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that in this movie. Like, this movie's not really interested in telling you much of anything.
No.
Like, it just feels like a snapshot of a time where these characters are going about their business, and you got to fill in your own blanks for the most part.
Very true, yeah.
Which I think can be frustrating to some viewers, but if you just kind of want to drop into somebody's life in this little vampire story, like, that is very much what this is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you think about it?
I mean, I think you liked it a little more than I did, but there were things about it that I did really enjoy. Like, the extreme 90s of it made me very nostalgic.
Yeah.
For, like, a very specific time in, like, indie films, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the time where you would find these little hidden gems on VHS when you went to Blockbuster on Friday, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, where
that's exactly
you would spend forever walking up and down the aisles yep. and then just pick something at random. You end up with blood and donuts and be like, wow, I found this little hidden gem. And I think this would be, had I found it in the 90s, something I was super into. And, like, even the opening shot, it's funny that you were going romantic comedy. It made me, because it's, like, shot on, like, a sunrise mm-hmm. and, like, somebody's boots. Before he starts golfing, the first thing I thought of actually was that movie Hardware. I don't know why. Maybe
Wait, what
more.
Movie is that?
Have you ever seen Hardware?
I don't know.
Oh God, it's this movie from I think either the late 80s or early 90s. I'm pretty sure early 90s, where it's like a dystopian sci-fi movie where this guy finds a robot head, and he takes it home to like add to like an art project. And,
I'm not sure I've ever seen that.
But it turns out it's like this, you know, like put itself back together, like killer robot.
Yeah.
And it just does that and starts hunting them.
Ooh, that sounds cool. I've never seen that.
It's a very odd movie, but absolutely, if you've never seen it, you should totally. There is a specific, I think it is like the VHS quality to mm-hmm. it that takes me instantly back to a time of like slumber parties and watching random shit that we rented. And I kind of, as much as I love how much access we have to media now, there was something special about like treasure hunting in that time period
yeah.
that immediately took me back to. So the nostalgia of it definitely is something that appealed to me. I thought the Rita character, even though she's like an antagonist in the story, it was actually a pretty interesting twist for a vampire movie.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it's a very well-worn, well-trodden subgenre. But I don't know that I've ever seen like a spurned vampire lover who wants to be turned into a, like, it's sort of like a twist on Renfield, right?
Yeah.
She's someone who almost got to have this kiss of forever life, and then got ghosted, and then has had to live with that knowledge of almost having been immortal, and then like how that would mess with you.
Yeah.
And then how, but through the lens of an ex, like an obsessed ex-girlfriend, it was just like a unique take on that. So I appreciated that. Again, like, I don't know how feminist it is, but it's certainly interesting. And of course, we talked about Cronenberg, who shows up in this. And like, he gives a very wooden performance, but in a way that is very charming and appealing. Yes. He did genuinely, like, the laughs that I got out of this movie were from him. There's a whole speech about leaving a mark versus leaving a smudge.
Oh, that was great.
Right? And I think it's because even though he's not an actor, you get the sense of how much fun he's having, mm-hmm. that you kind of just want to go along with it. It doesn't matter. It's the same thing, like I said, he had his Tarantino moment. And what I meant by that is not necessarily that him and Tarantino, it's like a similar style or anything, but like how when Tarantino does his cameos in movies,
right.
He's not the best actor in the movie by any.
Right, right. Like Reservoir Dogs. Like he's in that, you know.
Yes.
And you can tell, yes. He's having so much fun.
But he's having a great, yeah. time, and we're all just kind of like, you know, like winking, mm-hmm. at what's happening on screen. It's not a thing where it pulls you into the movie. It does become kind of meta and pull you out, but you're just having a fun time with him, and I felt that with Cronenberg. He is in a different movie than everyone else, but I'm enjoying his movie as well.
Right, right.
So the music, I don't know if you looked up the soundtrack for this.
No.
It's a very odd soundtrack in that it is 50s songs, and yep. then like the most 90s songs by Concrete Blonde. And the 50s songs don't totally make sense because like he supposedly went to sleep in the 60s, but whatever. It's a little anachronistic. It's fine. I can live with that. But the soundtrack is actually by this Canadian musician called Nash the Slash.
Okay.
And like we were just kind of joking about it as we watched the movie because like Nash the Slash is a funny name or whatever. So
yeah.
out of curiosity, I looked him up. He's like this Canadian musician who did like all this electronic music starting in the 70s. And he did it all behind bandages. His face is he wears goggles and bandages like Invisible Man style.
Yeah.
And it was a political commentary, but like he never showed his face.
Huh.
I recommend looking up Nash the Slash. He's an interesting character. I won't go too deep into all of his politics and stuff, but like he literally looks like the Invisible Man, and that's how he performed his entire career.
Weird.
Yeah. Yeah, so that I really, and I loved the electronic soundtrack or score,
yeah.
to this movie.
Yeah, there was a lot of great stuff there.
I mean, like, electronic scores are definitely something that have made a comeback. Mm-hmm. Like, there is, like, because, like, I think directors have aged, who watched all those movies have aged in
positions, you're probably right.
where they're, like, able to make movies themselves now. And those are the movies they grew up loving. So there's, like, that resurgence of that kind of soundtrack. But this is something that is, like, native to the time period and is not 80s. It's 90s, mm-hmm. which is a little bit different and something that is a fun little, you know, I really enjoyed it. Again, also, it's like nostalgic, it's my youth, whatever.
Right, right.
And then I liked the weird stinger at the end. Did you stick around after the credits for the weird stinger?
No. There was a stinger? Damn.
Yes. Yes. So in the after the credits, Rita, who has bandages on her head from trying to kill herself,
okay.
wanders into the donut shop and is hanging out with the donut shop owner talking about how she has a self-inflicted gun wound. And then the surviving tough shows up and sits down next to her and like kind of hits on her.
Oh, that's great.
And then it just ends. And then so we were like joking, like, what if Samuel L. Jackson came in and was like, do you want to join the Boya Initiative? And honestly, I feel like I like the movie even more after hearing the context, which is something I think is a recurring, yeah. pattern with these movies. For one thing, it really does illuminate what a labor of love the movie is. And so I feel warmer to it, knowing exactly what went into it and how it was a springboard for her career. Definitely adds to my enjoyment of the movie, even though, you know, obviously I've already watched it. But also the idea that it really is meant to focus on people on the fringes of society, which I mean, obviously that's the case. It's like late night donut shop, bad right. guys, vampires.
In a really like run down poor neighborhood.
Right. But I don't know that I necessarily had made that, like I hadn't really had that thought. So once it's in that context, then like I kind of feel like it's again, like this weird little vignette, mm-hmm. of a group of people with very little backstory. Like, I don't even think we understand why the bad guys want Earl. Do we? it doesn't matter.
No, but... I mean, it kind of seemed like he was working as, like, a driver for them, and he's, like, seen too much, maybe, or...
Yeah, it's unclear. We know Cronenberg wants them to deal with him, but we don't necessarily know why. And it doesn't really matter, again. It's because I said it's like you just get sort of dropped into this world in the same way that Boya just sort of gets dropped into this world. Yeah, because he just
shows up at this random, you know, donut shop, and then all this shit starts happening to him.
Right, which is fine. I mean, like, it's the 90s. We're deep in Seinfeld at this point. Like, we don't, not everything has to adhere to a very specific structure. So that I liked about it. But like I said, I don't know that I loved it quite as much as you. So let's talk maybe about some things that didn't work for us in the movie.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there were a few. I had some mixed feelings about the Rita character. You've already touched on that. Mostly I was pretty charmed by this movie, but, I did have a couple of questions where things were like, I wasn't quite sure about why they had it happen. So for instance, okay, so Rita ends up like basically alerting Molly to the fact that Boya is a vampire. 'Cause Molly, the donut shop girl, didn't realize that before. I mean, it seems like she kind of had her suspicions, but didn't really know. Right. So she finds out, and then Rita tells Boya that, and he goes running out in daylight to Molly as though she were in some kind of danger, and he ends up, like, almost dying from the sunlight in order to get to her.
Yeah.
Why did he do that? Like, she wasn't in any danger, right? All she had was this new information, like, that he could have waited a few hours.
Well, I think he was just, like... you know, like, she had blown it for him. And so he wanted to, like, get to her and, like, explain himself. But I don't know why he decided.
It was a poor judgment call. Because then he's not even able to really explain himself in any kind of way. Because he's, like, almost dead and has to drink her blood in order to survive. And also, okay, this is really dumb. But why do people always cut their palms when they're trying to do, like, blood anything? That would be, like, the last place on my body I would cut.
Right? Like, all the nerve endings in there and, like... You know, like, having to try to get that part of your hand to heal, like, every time you flex it. Yeah, no. I would not go for the middle of my hand. Absolutely not. Yeah,
I
know that's
super dumb, but it just, I always think that, like, what is your problem? Why did you do that?
I think it's just one of those weird movie things that becomes, like, self-perpetuating.
Yeah.
Is my only guess.
Yeah. I also don't know that I fully understood the meaning of the golf ball, other than it's what woke him up. But he holds on to it throughout the entire movie, and then finally when he dies at the end, he, like, releases it, you know, and you, like, the camera focuses on the golf ball again. I don't think I quite understood if the director or the screenwriter was trying to say something specific with that.
Is it just, like, the randomness of
maybe
fate? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it also kind of looks like the moon.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. I guess that's true.
I mean, I hadn't, these are things I'm coming up with off the cuff, to be honest. Yeah. I hadn't spent that much time thinking about the golf ball. Like, I just thought it was one of those weird things about the movie. But I'm guessing there probably is some sort of symbolism.
Yeah.
I mean, because there's, like, this whole sun-moon thing, right? Like,
yes, definitely.
Now I feel like I wish I had spent more time thinking about this. But
well, I appreciated a lot of the practical effects. That was, the electrocute, like, when they, when Molly electrocutes Earl.
That's in my cons as well. That whole scene, so I'm like, cheesy. I'm calling shenanigans on the science, because we're assuming he died from internal injuries from falling from a second story building.
Right.
Did the electricity fix all of that?
Yeah. I mean, you could just maybe immediately die again. It, like, restarting his heart, I think, is what they wanted to go for there, but.
Right.
But I don't think that's necessarily what killed him.
Right. Yeah. Like, it wasn't like a delayed heart attack.
Right. Exactly.
So I was like, is he just gonna be in excruciating pain and die?
Yeah. And those, like, lights just, like, kind of pulsing across his body.
It was a choice.
Yeah.
I was like, are there ghosts in the car? Like, yeah. What is happening? What's
happening here? Yeah, because I feel like it's not as though they couldn't have made that look better. So it does seem to be something, like, that they intentionally chose to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Also, his baths were, like, super gross.
Yeah.
Like, the water was always disgusting looking. And, like,
well, it's like a milk bath, right?
Yeah. It looked nasty. And then even when he's, like, washing off blood, like, you can't just like get into a bathtub covered in blood and step out of it. Like, that's not how it works. You're just like covered in watery blood now.
Yeah. I agree.
I was gonna ask you if when he's drinking the blood of the rat, like, did that really gross you out? Because there's so many mouth sounds in that scene.
You act like I watched that part.
I knew it.
I mean, you know, like, as soon as he started banging through the wall to get the rat, I was like, nope, mute. I know it's fake. I just don't like it.
Yeah.
So, and it's not going to ruin the movie for me not to hear the rat squeak. So I was like, nope. There'll be none of that.
Well, you also missed him like slurping. So
ugh, good. God. See, now I feel even more validated in my choice to hit.
So what were some of your cons?
For me, the biggest con, well, there's a couple things. Like, I feel like the end is extremely abrupt, and
that's true.
I don't quite know that. I mean, like, I get that he's like a sad vampire and sad vampires sometimes want to die, but I don't really feel like that was set up enough to, so felt like it was coming out of left field. So that's probably my main con, aside from I really dislike the dream sex scene.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up too.
Because the world has moved on a lot around these kinds of things, but like sure. It did not feel sexy to me. It felt extremely non-consensual.
Right.
And I was very creeped out about, like, even Boya in general, with all his interactions with Molly, I found very not romantic at all, but they were, but I think they're like a vestige of a particular kind of like vampire sexiness that I no longer, I'm not into at all. There is a Twilight thing that is happening around, like, he has chosen her and he is invading her sleep and he is hanging out at her work and he is scaring her and he is like running, like, you know what I mean? He's following her home. He's a creep around the Molly stuff. And I get that vampires are these like romantic characters and he's very cherub faced, very much set up to be a romantic vampire. But for me in 2020, it just landed in a way that was like super creep factor. So yeah, I totally understand that it's a product of its time. And if I were reviewing this in 1995, it would not even register, but I'm reviewing it in 2020 and I don't love that scene.
Yeah.
All of his interactions with Earl, I enjoy way more. Even there's like a small homoerotic moment where like he puts his hand on Earl's leg and Earl's like not into it, but he doesn't press the issue. And I don't feel like there's any of that give and take with him and Molly at all. Like, she is essentially like, she kind of pushes back, but she's pretty much under his thrall from the jump. And there's not a lot around her making the choice to be involved with him.
Yeah, so. that's true. And yeah, his interactions with Earl I thought were pretty charming and funny most of the time, but you definitely, yeah, didn't get that same effect with Molly.
Mm-hmm.
You're right about that. And yeah, the sex scene, dream scene was weird and uncomfortable.
Yeah, it was not great. I mean, she was even asleep through it. Whereas he was awake and, like, actively participating, and she was,
If they had both been asleep and it was, like, they were just having some weird connection in dream world, I think it would have felt really different.
Felt like he was doing it intentionally.
Right.
And I get, like, vampires do shit like that, but it just doesn't make them a romantic character to me. It makes them a predator. And that's fine if that's what you're going for, but I feel like the intent of it was to feel like this was, like, a love story, and I didn't feel like it
really was. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that we've like almost like misshapen vampires that way, like made it. I mean, because even like early vampire, I'm just thinking of Dracula, like
not a Dracula, creep. Dracula.
Fuck, I so knew that was gonna come up at some point. I kept telling, like, last night as I was falling asleep, I was like, say vampire, don't say Dracula. Ariel, don't say Dracula.
That's rewarding to longtime listeners of the Zombie Girls. Yeah. Everyone else will be like, what?
What the fuck are you talking about? So, like, if you think back to the, like, original Dracula, I mean, he is a predator. Like, you're not...
Yeah.
I mean, there's supposed to be, like, some sort of romanticism there. He's handsome. He's going after these beautiful women. But he's sneaking into their bedrooms at night. He's doing to them things to them while they're asleep or while they're in his thrall. Like, I feel like we left some of that behind at a certain point.
Right. Grabbed the sexy, but, like, left. Like, in this case, he's very, like, very sad Kurt Cobain vampire.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, he's the damaged, sad... He's doing all the predatory things. He's so sympathetic now, or meant to be so sympathetic now, that, like, he's only biting the bad guys, and yet he's still maintaining these sexual predatory things.
Right, exactly.
And he's our hero instead of our antagonist.
Yeah, I mean, the director did say that one of the things that this movie did was kind of... that it was similar to her documentaries, in that all the characters are kind of anti-heroes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And she also talked about how she really wanted this movie to kind of be this, like, almost like a tender story about trading in loneliness for friendship.
Hmm.
That he was that. This, you know, that everybody's kind of these, like, lonely figures who come together in friendship, and that he ultimately has to, or ultimately decides to, like, give up his own life so that the people he made friends with can be safe.
Right.
So I don't know if all of that came through exactly, but I see it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I picked up on that specifically. In retrospect, with the explanation, I can kind of piece that together. I understand that he's supposed to be protecting them by backing away from sacrificing himself, but it seemed like they had their own problems long before he entered the picture with the Canadian toughs.
That's true.
And the only thing that she was really in danger from was him.
Yeah.
But was she really? I don't know. Sure. If that's the intent, then I'm not going to say it's not. I don't know 100% if it came through, but
yeah, I don't think it was 100% successful, but I think there are pieces of it that are in there.
Yeah. And, like, I know I sound, like, really harsh on this movie, but it's only because we're in the context of criticizing it.
Yeah, like, no. Absolutely.
I would not, you know what I mean? This is far from being the most offensive vampire movie I've ever seen.
Oh, God,
like,
no.
With the worst sexual politics ever, but.
And I do think you're right about the sort of VHS nature of this and the time period that it was made in. Like, I think, you know, if in high school or something I had seen this on late night TV or picked it up at Blockbuster, I think I would have really enjoyed it, you know? And I was charmed by a lot about this movie. Mm-hmm. I thought a lot of it was fun and yeah, charming.
I mean, it's an odd little movie.
It really is.
And that is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, I just think ultimately it is a victim of how popular the genre was after it. Like, there is a temptation to be like to compare these to things like Buffy or Twilight, but this predates both of those things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this came out a couple years before Buffy and a couple decades before Twilight. And it's just a victim of being a part of a genre that was so oversaturated in the subsequent years. And, you know, but despite that, I do recommend. Do you recommend this movie? Would you recommend it?
I would, especially if you watch a lot of horror movies, and then I would definitely recommend this. But I honestly think somebody who had never seen a horror movie could think this was fun. Like, put it on late at night with a group of friends, and I think you'd have fun watching it.
Yeah, there's definitely some standout visual moments in this movie. Mm-hmm. Specifically, him in the bathtub with all of the feathers on his mouth is probably the biggest one for me.
Yeah, that was a great moment.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend checking it out because it's so odd.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you like Canadian humor.
Yeah, there's something about the pacing of it that's kind of similar, you know?
And also just, like, kind of the odd characters that are just kind of in a single location kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, there's a very, like, small town, isolated, even though it's in Toronto. So, yeah, I would recommend it just for the sake of, like, it being kind of an odd, interesting movie, and for Cronenberg's cameo, which is really, really fun.
Yeah, if you're a Cronenberg fan at all, you got to see this one.
So yeah, A Blood and Donuts. It's definitely interesting. Check it out. I recommend checking it out. It was on Amazon Prime. It's disappeared from there, unfortunately. That's a correction.
Oh, yeah, definitely a correction.
2 weeks ago, or I guess 3 weeks ago, it was on Amazon Prime, I swear to God. And then in the, like, 3 days between when I said that and when we watched the movie, it was gone.
Yeah. It was very frustrating.
Sorry about that for those of you playing along at home. Hopefully it'll pop up there again. Right now it's not streaming anywhere as far as I know.
Yeah.
But it will. I mean, it feels like something that'll get picked up and, like, pop up. Like, maybe, I wonder if it's on, like, Tubi or something. Oh. I'm sure it's gettable.
Yeah.
All right, so for those of you at home who had some thoughts on this movie or maybe have a movie you'd like to recommend that we check out, please do drop us a line at rachel@zombiegirls.com. You can also, if you're liking the show, review us on iTunes. And if you're looking for something to watch tonight, we're all stuck at home, right? Need something to kill some time? Don't know what's on the VODs? Well, good news, we have the answers. If you visit zombiegirls.com, check out our VOD release dates. It's a calendar of horror movies that are available on VOD right now, as well as some really cool upcoming movies. I think this week, stuff that's out this week includes Sea Fever, which is directed by a woman and probably, spoiler alert, will be something we'll be reviewing fairly soon.
Yeah.
Also, Underwater is out, which is a movie that like came and went in the theaters and is a shame because it's actually super fun.
So much fun.
Don't read anything about it. Go in cold. That is my advice to you. The colder you go into that movie, the more fun you're going to have with it. And I haven't watched it yet, but there's a movie up called Butt Boy that has good reviews about some guy that like can like disappear things into his butt.
That's like one of the most interesting ideas for a movie I've right? ever heard.
Yeah, I don't know anything else about it, but I'm gonna check it out on name alone. Anyway, so I guess it just leaves what we're planning on doing for our next episode, and it is my turn.
Yeah, what do you got for us?
Oh, this has been really hard because there's like 10 things I want to pick. but I wanted to make it easy, so I picked something that is on Netflix streaming so okay. that everybody can get it. It is a movie called Headcount, directed by Elle Callahan. Have you ever heard of this?
It sounds familiar, but I have such a shit memory. Tell me what it's about, Rachel.
Okay, I'll tell you what it's about, and if you've already seen it or you don't want to cover it, then I have mm-hmm. backups. But okay, so here's the description from Netflix. A group of college students on a weekend getaway accidentally summon a supernatural entity intent on using them for a deadly ritual. So, I mean, that sounds kind of generic. Whatever, but it's one that, like, I go on Reddit all the time, which is, like, the horror Reddit.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, people will be like, did anybody check this movie out? This was actually pretty good.
Oh.
And so I've been wanting to see it forever because of that. And then when I started researching it and I saw that it was directed by a woman, I was like, oh, yeah, we're going to need to do that.
Yeah, no, so I have not seen it.
The reviews are kind of mixed. Some people really like it. Some people are kind of like, eh. But that's how you find the hidden gems, right?
Yeah, plus either way, it should probably give us something interesting to talk about.
And there is a particular word that I've seen bandied about around this movie that I'm not going to say on here in case it's okay. a spoiler, but it's something that makes it, I think, something you and I will have fun talking about.
Okay, so, cool.
So yeah, Headcount. Next episode, everybody at home who's playing along, check out Headcount on Netflix. Ariel, my darling, my dear, my queen of the Pacific Northwest.
Aww.
Will you please take us out?
Yeah, so thanks for listening, everybody. This has been episode 4 of the More Deadly podcast. If you have any ideas for movies we should watch in the future, or if you had anything interesting to say about this last movie that we watched or any of the others we watched in previous episodes, please hit us up on email or come find us on our Facebook page. But yeah, that's it. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
My post-caffeine life is dark, man.
Oh,
I just gotta sing it out.